We are movie geeks.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
I'm walking here!
You talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I amuse you.
I ate his liver with some fava bean and a nice Chianti.
Here's Johnny!
He's looking at you, kid.
Welcome to We Are Movie Geeks, the show. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
Today is June 15th, 2015. We talk about movies, we go to movies, we write about movies. What we'd like to talk about to start off, as we usually do, is the box office over the weekend. I think there may have been one movie that dominated, Michelle.
It was Jurassic World.
Oh, my God.
Boy, did it ever. I mean, the expectations for this were already mammoth, but the massive box office weekend, it opened, estimates have it at, right now, $204 million domestic, which would put it at the second all-time leader behind Marvel's The Avengers. But like I said, the studios will put out their final numbers later on today. It's going to be known for having the biggest global opening with $511 million.
Holy smokes, that's a half a billion dollars.
Gee, many.
Yeah. So, and like it's, the studios will have the final numbers out today. So we'll, you know, right now, Chris Pratt is that guy is gold.
Mm-hmm.
That guy can open any movie now. I mean, after 2014's the Lego movie,
yes.
And after his other Guardians of the Galaxy,
Star Lord.
Telling you, the guy.
Yeah, this is a guy that was on a sitcom for several years that barely got to six seasons. It was always on the cusp of being canceled, and now he's maybe the biggest star in the world at this moment, box office wise.
Variety had a great article on the five big reasons why the movie did better than expected. Chris Pratt, the timing of the release. I mean, it's a great spot to open this kind of movie. The director, Colin Trevorrow's, coming from indie Safety Not Guaranteed film. Now, I mean, this guy. And people really wanted to see it in IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
They really wanted to see it in that big, people in California, they were paying $19 to see it in IMAX.
Mm.
And you know what? People wanted to see dinosaurs again.
Mm-hmm.
They were taking
their
little kids to see it.
It's been 15 years since the last Jurassic Park film. And in fairness to the other studios, nobody wanted to go near this weekend. I mean, it had absolutely no competition. What was number two, Spy?
The number two spot was Spy, with $16 million, and then San Andreas.
So $204 million versus $16 million for number two.
Mm-hmm. That other little independent movie, which is gaining a lot of traction, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, that opened in six markets at 15 theaters. So it came out with a respectable $210,000.
Good.
Well, not many theaters. That's pretty good.
Exactly.
I think it's going to be one of those ones that kind of just builds and word of mouth will take it over there. But it'll be interesting to see what World does next weekend when they get a little more competition.
It'll probably just be $100 million, but that'll be a 50% drop. But it'll still be enough.
Which, can you imagine now what Star Wars will do in December?
Yeah,
I remember earlier in the season, one of our reviewer friends was insistent that he thought that 50 Shades of Grey would be the second highest grossing film of the year behind maybe Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Like, silly reviewer.
No.
Well, let's talk about Jurassic World. We all saw it last week at a screening before it opened.
You just went and made a new dinosaur?
Probably not a good idea.
Almost 40 feet high. Really think she climbed out?
Depends.
On what?
What kind of dinosaur they cooked up in that lab.
I reviewed it. I gave it 3 out of 5 stars. I think it really delivered on the dinosaur action. A little less on the human story. But people don't go to see Jurassic World for the human story. They go to see Jurassic World to see dinosaurs destroy this theme park, and the movie delivered with that. I thought some of the script was sort of perfunctory. I thought some of the performances, especially Bryce Howard, were sort of weak. I didn't feel they did a great job of integrating the humans within the spectacle. I felt I was watching actors standing in front of a green screen. But still, these dinosaurs were pretty amazing. Although I did think, what did they call them?
Indominus Rex.
Yes,
Indominus Rex.
I kept thinking they were going to bring out like a bigger Indominus, like kind of like in Gorgo, where you have the big monster attacking, and then it turns out the mother monster, which is 5 times bigger, because Indominus didn't seem really that much bigger than a T-Rex.
Well, yeah, I liked how they, well, not giving a whole lot away, they pit the other dinos against it. And, mm-hmm. and when they do bring on, you know, one of the big guns from the first Jurassic Park, you're kind of hoping there's maybe going to be a couple of them. So we'll get to see like a tag team thing between them. We got to see a little bit of that with the raptors. But when, you know, they decided to sick the raptors on them, I'm like, really? These, you know, it's just, this Dominus is pretty savage. So I don't know if these guys are going to be able to take him on. But they did their best. You know, it's commendable. And of course, the mercenaries, you know, they didn't have to stand a chance, of course.
Yeah, and then you had Vincent D'Onofrio as the military contractor who wanted to use the raptors as weapons of war, and he was played pretty broadly. You knew he was doomed pretty much after he spoke his first couple sentences.
Yeah, but I'm not going to fault Bryce Dallas Howard because that was a thankless role.
Right.
You know? That's,
and running with heels the whole movie.
Outrunning a T-Rex in heels.
Yeah, I don't
That's
know if any you know, actress could have you know made that character really, you know, really pop because she's just kind of... You know, she's a little bit of a love interest. And she's, you know, a little bit of a plot device.
Well, again, this the script let her down a bit. But then again... Nobody's going to avoid seeing Jurassic World because critics don't like the script.
Oh, no, and it will have repeat viewings.
Yeah.
People
will be back seeing it again this weekend if they already haven't.
The one sequence or maybe one shot really resonates with me is you get to see they actually have sort of a petting zoo with the dinosaurs, and there's a very quick shot of a baby brontosaurus meeting a little kid, and he immediately rushes up and hugs the brontosaurus.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is one of the main appeals of the film. Kids just, you know, there's a certain age where kids just love anything to do with dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's certainly going to be a big hook for this, though, about repeat viewing. That's for certain.
Mm-hmm. And the dinosaur technology has certainly come a long way. Even Jurassic Park, which was 22 years ago, 23 years ago.
22, yeah.
That was a 2.5 hour long film, which is a half hour longer than this one. And there was only 15 minutes of dinosaur footage. And about half of that was Stan Winston's animatronics. So we're talking 7 or 8 minutes of CGI in the original Jurassic Park. And it kind of blew everybody away at the time, but that's just nothing. I mean, that's still a better film. Because of the script and the direction, but boy, did these dinosaurs, they've just gotten so photorealistic, you can't fault them.
Yeah, and one of my main problems with the reboot or remake a couple of summers ago was with Godzilla. It just took forever, it seemed like, to get to the monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And here, you know, you once you're on that island, you get to see them pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's going to help the box office also. There's not a lot of lag time before the mayhem starts.
Sure. You know, and there was an adequate score by Michael Giacchino, although,
yeah.
I mean, it was kind of almost phoned in. I mean, you had to have John Williams' music to connect.
Yeah,
you know,
and they
really
did.
Get everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do.
Yeah, of course, if they had not had it in there, people would have complained.
Oh, yeah, no, it was...
Some people complain they're using it too much now. Mm-hmm.
It was definitely weaved through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, the scenery in it there in Hawaii, I think this was shot in Hawaii, a lot of it there, it's just gorgeous, you know. So
it's definitely one to see in IMAX, if possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know about the 3D. I know there's some sequences that the 3D helps, but mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a 100% thing that you really have to see it.
I thought the 3D had a lot of depth compared to Tomorrowland and even San Andreas. But I think San Andreas is a slightly better film. When I watched San Andreas, I thought I was watching a story about a man, you know, rescuing his family from these earthquakes. With Jurassic World, I thought I was watching a story about dinosaurs attacking a theme park, and then there was these sort of poorly written human characters that just sort of reacted. They didn't do as good a job, like I say, of integrating the humans' characters or the actors within the film. I never felt the actors and the dinosaurs were sort of existing in the same plane the way I did with San Andreas.
It's been a fun summer popcorn movie season. Between San Andreas and now Jurassic World.
Mad Max
and, you know, name it, Pitch Perfect 2. There's been something for everybody, and
yeah.
It's been...
In Tomorrowland. No, just kidding.
Yeah, I have been reading some articles and hearing some stuff about Tomorrowland this past week, and I think Cartoon Brew had a piece on it a few days ago saying that it's going to be the big bomb for Disney. It seems like every couple of years, there's one film that Disney releases that just is like a money pit. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, it was John Carter. A couple of years ago, it was Lone Ranger. Now Tomorrowland, they're saying it's going to lose at least $140 million from its, I guess, production cost.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if the only bright side of it is that that Brad Bird is really starting to work on Incredibles 2. Which,
there you go.
You know, the live action's loss is animation's gain there. Mm-hmm. So it's we've been dying for another Incredibles movie, so finally that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I'd be wondering if the axe is going to fall on anybody over.
Well, Tomorrowland is a lousy movie. It deserves to bomb.
Yeah,
I think John Carter and Lone Ranger were both. I liked both of those movies.
Really like John Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, we've got some mutual friends that insist Lone Ranger is going to be a classic that people will appreciate in years to come, but I don't know if we're going to be alive for that.
I don't know. I've watched Lone Ranger a couple of times on Blu-ray.
What's funny is the Man from U.N.C.L.E., the trailers, everything about it, when they talk about Armie Hammer, mm-hmm. they don't mention Lone Ranger at all. Well, all they mention is Social Network.
Well, they mention it in Entourage.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they find out, well, Vince is dating this actress that used to date Armie Hammer, and he says he's going to come after you. He said, "Oh, you mean the Lone Ranger?" So no one wants to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for certain.
But Jurassic World is, of course, a dinosaur movie, and which got us to thinking about some of our favorite dinosaur movies. You mentioned Gertie the Dinosaur. That was 1915, I believe.
Maybe even a little sooner than that.
I've been making dinosaur movies for 100 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, with Gertie, it's sort of a milestone in animation and in dinosaurs,
mm-hmm.
and it sort of was the first film that tried to integrate live action with animation, mm-hmm. because the way the film was set up, Winsor McCay, the noted cartoonist from Little Nemo and Slumberland, actually animated, hand drew this film and made it part of a stage act in vaudeville and, you know, in theaters back in the day. And he would come out in his tux and his little whip there and say, you know, I brought a dinosaur here to entertain us. And then the film would start and he'd yell commands at Gertie on screen. And, you know, Gertie would lift his leg lift her leg and dance a little bit. And there was even a sequence with another dinosaur. And, you know, Gertie would chomp a tree. And then I think would actually throw a rock at the other dinosaur. And I guess people were just stunned at it. Yeah. And it was maybe the first film where the animated character had a real kind of personality to it, you know. So that that made it a milestone in more than a couple of ways there. But it pops up every once in a while on TCM.
Yeah.
It's a great film. Actually, one of the Disney Hour shows that they've been running on TCM sort of recreated the stage act and had an actor playing Winsor McCay. And it's just really fascinating.
Neat. Yeah, I used to rent that from the library on 8mm film when I was a kid. And watch it down in my basement, Gertie the Dinosaur.
Of course, at the end of it, Winsor would actually go on into the screen itself and you know, take a ride off the stage there with Gertie. So,
yeah, what other dinosaur movies do you like, Jim?
Well, I've got a fondness for Valley of Guanji.
Oh, me too.
What you are about to see has never been seen before by human eyes.
Oh, yeah. Well, anything that Ray Harryhausen does is just golden. And this was had its start, I guess, with Willis O'Brien. Mm-hmm. Didn't he always have an idea about doing a film with cowboys and dinosaurs?
Yeah, and he actually did one. He did The Beast from Hollow Mountain, which wasn't very good.
Yeah. So this was kind of Harryhausen's sort of follow-up on that. And, you know, a big screen, full Technicolor deal. And I believe it stars James Franciscus. Mm-hmm. And
Gina Golden.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. And, it's terrific. I remember seeing it in my hometown theater, the Capitol Theater in Benton, Illinois. And there's a sequence when the Cowboys first has come across this kind of goofy dinosaur and they're chasing it and it sort of runs around the corner or something like that, and all of a sudden there's Guanji, there's the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Mm-hmm. And I remember the audience just gasping because it's just a magnificent looking creature. And he really, Ray, you know, usually when he was doing dinosaurs for movies like Animal World, mm-hmm. he's having to do a bunch of them, or with 1 Million Years BC. But here, you know, especially towards the end of the film when Guanji is captured, he's kind of concentrating right on the T-Rex, and he's just really going all out, especially in a sequence when I believe it's trapped or stomping through a big church or cathedral or something like that. And it's terrific. And there's even a sort of tribute to one of Harryhausen's earlier films. I believe Guanji takes on an elephant in one sequence, doesn't it?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's kind of a throwback to
20 Million Miles to Earth.
Yeah, with Ymir and the elephants.
So yeah, speaking of Animal World, they showed Trog over the weekend on Turner Classic Movies, which was 1970, Joan Crawford's final film. And
this kill crazy fiend from hell must be destroyed.
She finds it's a pretty cheesy film, but she finds this caveman and takes him back and tries to rehabilitate him. But they're monitoring his dreams in one sequence, and they show clips from Animal World, which is the Ray Harryhausen thing. I think those clips have actually shown up in a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah. Yes. Well, you know what's one of the funny bits in Jurassic World? In the opening sequences, one of the kids who's dinosaur crazy has an old ViewMaster, and he's looking at slides of dinosaurs. And I swear they have a couple of the Willis O'Brien stills from The Lost World. From the 1920s.
Films. 1925, yeah.
Speaking of Jurassic World, news has just broke that Jurassic World now holds the record for the biggest opening in movie history.
Domestic?
It broke. Yeah, Variety's reporting the final numbers, even though they're still being tallied. It has inched past Marvel's The Avengers to become the top dog with a debut of roughly $209 million.
Holy smokes.
It came out stronger than anticipated, with Sunday, with the NBA Finals and Game of Thrones. So right now it has made movie history, and it has become the biggest opening weekend in history.
Bravo. Take that, Tomorrowland. It made its entire budget back, and then some, its opening weekend.
Yeah, Universal execs must be saying, why didn't we come out with another Jurassic?
Yeah, why didn't they do this 10 years ago?
Yeah, really. So, that's really amazing.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But, and it costs $150 million to produce. So.
Yeah. Probably another $50 in marketing.
Yeah, well, usually they say, it has to triple its production cost. So
exactly.
It's all gravy from here, I guess.
Well, good for those guys. And that means we can get a sequel in a year or two or three.
Right.
Yeah. But 100 years of dinosaur movies. Holy cow. Michelle, what are some of your favorite dinosaur movies from the past?
I'm kind of partial to 1993's Carnosaur, produced by Roger Corman. The funny thing about that one is, go figure, that's when, Jurassic Park is released, starring Laura Dern. Well, her mom, Diane Ladd, stars in Carnosaur, inferior.
Is she like the mad scientist in
there? She's the mad scientist. If you watch the trailer has just the one-liners, the zingers.
The Earth was not made for us. She was made for the dinosaurs. The Earth was scaled to their dimensions. Human beings are ants crawling through their living rooms.
It had a modest box office take of $1.8 million, and it spawned two official sequels. I don't think we'll be seeing Carnosaur anytime soon.
No.
Another one of my favorite, heartfelt favorites is Disney's Dinosaur that came out in 2000. Has a lovely score by James Newton Howard. It was a huge financial success. The trailer, the first teaser trailer, was just stunning. It had huge box office receipts, $349 million. It became the fifth highest grossing film in 2000. It's just a wonderful mix of CGI, live action. Like I said, the teaser was great. It had a huge voice cast. So it's just one of those really sweet kind of, dinosaur movies. Along with Ice Age 3, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, which came out in 2009. Roger Ebert gave that. He was fawning all over that movie at the time. 3.5 stars, just, loved it. The next chapter in the Ice Age sequence there. And another one that I'm partial to is the 1960s Lost World by Irwin Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Had another big cast in it, Claude Rains. Yeah.
David Hedison,
Fernando St. Lamas, Michael Rennie. Yeah. It's just, you know, based on Arthur Conan Doyle's novel. And it's in Venezuela. It's got dinosaurs and carnivorous plants and giant spiders.
You'll see man-eating vines that lure their prey. Spiders as tall as trees. Hair-raising attack by prehistoric monsters.
And it's just an all-around fun movie.
It is really fun. It's a lot of colorful. I think Irwin Allen wanted to work with Ray Harryhausen on that picture,
yes.
But they couldn't make it happen. So they put in these iguanas that they put some fake scales on their back of their necks, which, you know, in retrospect, is really sort of endearing.
Yeah,
but imagine if it had been a Ray Harryhausen movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
they
definitely.
They did that in the 1941 million years BC flick, I think, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. And, well, you know, I recall when that original trailer for Dinosaur came out.
Yes.
And, and then when the film came out, I was like, oh, they're talking? I was hoping the whole thing would be kind of them running around and acting more natural. Yeah. But I guess they figured that people would lose interest or something.
I wonder how that movie holds up. After 11 or 12 years.
Yeah, I think it still does. I do. Like I said, and the score from James Newton Howard, it's one of his best scores. And if you want to sit down with your young child and watch it, it's still just a really nice, I think it still looks really good.
A couple of dinosaur movies that I like. When I was a kid, they used to show Dinosaurus on TV all the time.
Dinosaurus, the most amazing, astounding, astonishing adventure of them all, beyond anything your mind can imagine. Never before seen on the screen.
It was a really cheesy movie, and it had pretty low-grade stop-motion animation, but at least it had stop-motion animation. And it was about this boy, and he meets this caveman who has been unfrozen out of the ice, and there's a steam shovel battling the dinosaur at the end. Not a great movie, but a friend of mine owns a 16-millimeter print, and I've watched it many, many times, even as an adult. I think it's kind of a lot of fun.
It's kind of a brontosaurus, the dinosaurus itself.
There was a brontosaurus and a T-Rex.
Oh, okay, and they were they were both stop motion, huh?
Yeah, they were both stop motion. I'm not sure who did the stop motion for it, but it was pretty jerky. But that's okay. But my favorite dinosaur movie of all time is When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth, which was from Hammer Studios, 1 million years BC with Raquel Welch. 1968 was a huge hit, so Hammer Studios decided to do another dinosaur movie, which I think is better, When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth. Believe it or not, is the only Hammer film to be nominated for an Oscar. Jim Danforth was the animator who did these amazing dinosaur animation and just something about the way it's lit. It's just a really unusual looking some nighttime animation, and it stars an actress named Victoria Vetri, who was very sexy. She wore an even skimpier fur bikini than Raquel Welch did in one million years BC. That was made in 1970. Victoria Vetri was also Playmate of the Year in 1969. And she had an interesting story. She was actually in Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby. She was the woman that Mia Farrow met down in the basement in the laundry room, and then she ends up throwing herself out a window. She did Invasion of the B-Girls and a couple other cheesy films in the 70s, then sort of dropped out. And right now she's in prison. About 6 or 7 years ago, she shot her husband her common-law husband in the back with a gun that Roman Polanski had given her when they had an affair on the set of Rosemary's Baby, and she was up for parole. She's in her mid-60s. She was up for parole this last fall, and she was denied parole. So you got to wonder what a woman in prison has to do to get denied parole who's in her mid-60s like that.
Yeah. Well, as I recall, that When Dinosaurs has actually a little nudity in it.
Oh,
too,
yeah.
Unlike 1 million years BC.
Yeah, it's my favorite movie to collect paper on. I've got all the posters. I've got these door panel posters, which were 20 by 80. And there was two other beautiful European women, Imogene Hassel and Magda Konopka, who was a Polish actress. Miss Hassel died of a drug overdose. But Victoria Vetri did some nude scenes. The posters say rated G on them. And when the movie was released in the United States, these nude scenes were cut out. But if you get the DVD, which is actually out of print, it goes for a pretty pricey dollar. The nude scenes are reinstated.
And is it shot on the in the deserts of Spain?
I believe so. That's where
Harryhausen.
Yeah. A lot of the Harryhausen stuff was the Sinbad movies were shot in Spain as well. But yeah, When Dinosaurs Rule the Earth is my favorite. I also like, you know, King Kong. You got to sort of consider a dinosaur movie in its way. Besides the, you know, besides Kong, you've got a Stegosaurus and a Tyrannosaurus and a Pterodactyl, and all way ahead of their time. You know, I just watched King Kong again recently. It definitely holds up. And that was the special effects of Willis O'Brien. And The Lost World, which we mentioned in 1925, it was really sort of the original dinosaur movie. But I also like The Land That Time Forgot.
Fight for your life against the terrifying creatures of a lost continent. Come face to face with primitive man and learn the secret of evolution. The Land That Time Forgot.
There was this series in the early, mid-70s, Land That Time Forgot, People That Time Forgot, At the Earth's Core.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible special effects. They use these big, oversized, you know, puppets for dinosaurs, and the pterodactyls, their wings didn't even flap. But again, there's something sort of endearing about those movies. Doug McClure was the action hero of all of those. Peter Cushing was in one, and Carolyn Monroe was in one. They were successful.
Based on the books of Edgar Rice Burroughs and from Amicus Studios, I recall. Yeah,
Those were a lot of fun.
Who were kind of Hammer's rivals for a while, yeah.
So that brings us up to Jurassic World, which made $207 million. Is that what you said?
$209.
Holy cow. Wow. So, no other movies stood a chance, although there were a couple other movies. Art films opening here and there. Jim saw something called Results. Jim, tell us about Results. I think it opens in limited release in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. I think it's been playing on video on demand for a couple of weeks also. This is sort of, I guess it would be called a mumblecore sort of comedy. It's a low-budget deal, and it kind of feels like some of the people are, you know, improvising their lines and kind of making things up. But it's basically about a fella named Danny. He's kind of a schlubby guy, and when the film starts, he's been kicked out of the house and in his apartment in New York and can't get back in. And then all of a sudden they cut to Austin, Texas, and this health club, this health spa called Power for Life. You're assuming that it's several months later because Danny stumbles in there. And he's played by Kevin Corrigan, who might best be known as Henry Hill's younger brother from Goodfellas.
The guy that was stirring the spaghetti.
Oh, yes.
Stirring the...
Yeah, the sauce, keep the sauce stirring there. But he goes in there and he speaks with the owner of Power for Life, who is played by Guy Pearce. He goes into his office. He said, yeah, what are your goals if you want to sign up for our program? And he says, well, I want to be able to take a punch, you know? The guy says, okay, we could do that. And later on, Danny has rented a big mansion in Austin and wants a private trainer to come in and train him. And Guy is going to send, you know, one of his big burly male trainers over there, but one of his star trainers, Cat, played by Kobe Smulders. Cat hears about this. He says, I'll do it. I can handle this guy. It's, you know, fine. So she goes over there. Of course, there's a little flirtation going on in a romance, and the film kind of takes some unusual turns there. Some cameos, sort of supporting performances by Giovanni Ribisi as this sort of burned-out lawyer that Danny meets up with. And
is it funny, though?
Yeah, you know, if you like those actors and you're kind of interested in that subject matter, you might enjoy it.
Yeah, look for a review of that at wearemoviegeeks.com, our website. Another movie that opens soon, actually it opens this Friday, is we mentioned Pixar. Pixar has its newest. It is called Inside Out, and we have seen it. Jim and I have seen it.
I'm joy. This is sadness. That's anger.
What?
This is disgust. And that's fear.
Ah!
We're Riley's emotions.
Boy, I liked it a lot. I don't think it quite soars to the level of the very best Pixar films. I don't think it was as good as Toy Story 3 or Up.
Yeah, those are tough to top, though, man. Those are just classics.
You know, it's a very emotional film, and it's about emotions. And I felt, you know, that the emotions were a little forced. I also think it's got this whole abstract plot about the thought process. And I just wonder if, you know, smaller kids are going to be able to follow this film.
Well, I think they'll be attracted by the bright, bouncy, colorful characters.
Oh, they put a clown in there.
Yeah, Bing Bong.
Yeah.
Her Riley's imaginary friend when she was a little girl, who now is in the recesses, buried deep within the brain. My problem with it, I love the idea of it, but it just seems like this journey, this sort of getting back to where they started. trip that is inside the head just seems to be going on a little too long. And you're like, come on, let's pick up the pace a little bit. Some of the stuff outside Riley's, you know, you get to see what's going on inside her head and sort of outside. And, you know, she's dealing with the real world. Some of it doesn't quite connect, but it is a step up. You know, we don't need any more sequels for a while until Incredibles 2. So this is the first Pixar film we've had in a couple of years now.
Monsters U was the last.
Yeah, certainly miles above that, above the Cars films. Yeah. So, you know, it's got a nice, strong voice cast. I think Lewis Black just about steals it as Anger.
That's what the early reviews have been saying.
Yeah, he's really terrific in it. And, you know, it's actually Phyllis Smith has a major role in it, and she's very entertaining as Sadness, who becomes kind of an endearing character.
Yeah.
But luckily, it ends on a high note. The last 5 minutes or so are just some of the funniest sequences that Pixar has ever done.
Well, the premise is that there's five emotions living inside everyone's brain. Anger, fear, disgust, joy, and sadness. But I don't want to give much away, but at the very end, it's going into other characters' voices. There's a shot where it goes into this cat's head, and there's nobody at the controls.
Yeah, inside, and they picture the brain as sort of a souped-up, more colorful version of the Enterprise Bridge.
Yeah, but there's nobody in the cat's brain except this one cat who just kind of... It's hard to describe it. That's the biggest laugh I'm sure I'm going to have in 2015 was going inside that cat's brain, because I can't stand cats.
The film premiered at Cannes Film Festival to really great reviews. Along with those early reviews, people have been saying it's composer Michael Giacchino is one of his best scores ever.
Yeah, I think it's certainly better than his Jurassic World score, right? For sure. But yeah, he does terrific stuff for Pixar. I love his incredible score and his up score. And and it's you know,
I mean,
he's
like all over the place now. He's done, you know, the second eight movie. He's done Star Trek. I mean, he's kind of the golden boy now of.
It'll be interesting to see how it does against Jurassic World this weekend. We think Jurassic World is going to probably break 100 million. It's second week.
Yeah.
But
so, it'll be close between the two of them. It's got a cute little short at the start of it there.
Lava.
Which is cute. It's not as strong as some of their previous shorts.
It's not nearly as good as the Feast short from Big Hero 6 last year.
Or any of the Toy Story shorts that they've had. I enjoy those.
Was it Paper Man that won the Oscar 2 years
ago?
That did.
But,
not as good as that. I think Lava will probably be nominated for Best Animated Short.
Yeah. And there's a tirade that you talk about the scene in the cat's head. The tirade that Lewis Black goes on about San Francisco pizza is very funny. It's one of those not quite one of the definite, you know, classic Pixars, but you know, certainly an improvement over the last years. Certainly the best one since Brave, that's for certain.
I'd say it's the best since Toy Story 3, and certainly it's, you know, it's ambitious. We're sort of criticizing the plot as being a little too complicated, but you know, they really want to make you think, and in more ways than one.
It's just not about little, you know, objects coming to life or something like that. It's about something that really animation can really work with. You know, and 3D is pretty good too, as I remember. The 3D effects are nice.
Yeah, so that is Inside Out. We'll have a review up this Friday at wearemoviegeeks.com, the site. One of We Are Movie Geeks' favorite actors of all time passed away last week. Christopher Lee, Sir Christopher Lee, I should say, passed away at age 93 in London, England. It's pretty sad. I would have to say that he was the last of the great classic horror stars, and really the only horror star. What horror stars are left?
That's it. I guess would he represent to you, to digress a little bit, in comic books we have a golden age and silver age, and you would say, I guess maybe the golden age of horror is maybe starts with Lon Chaney Sr. and ends with Lon Jr., and the silver age would start, I guess, with Peter Cushing,
Curse of Frankenstein,
and Christopher Lee.
True.
And he's the last of the silver age stars.
Yeah. I mean, you could say Barbara Steele, but she's sort of a cult star. If you're not part of her cult, you probably couldn't name more than a couple of films she was in. Where everybody loved Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Vincent Price.
Well, it is sad about him passing, but he, you know, unlike, say, Bela Lugosi, who had kind of struggled at the end of his life, and maybe Lon Chaney Jr. was like that, Christopher Lee knew people loved him, you know, that he was beloved, he was celebrated, and appreciated, and still working.
And went out on a high note. He was in the Peter Jackson Hobbit films. And look at all the directors he worked with, too. He worked with Scorsese in Hugo. He worked with Spielberg in 1941. Tim Burton loved Christopher Lee. He put him in several of his films.
Yeah.
But then go back, he was with Mario Bava, The Whip and the Body. He worked with Jess Franco, the notorious Spanish director, in several films. In fact, most of Jess Franco's films that were released in the United States starred Christopher Lee. You know, what other actor has worked with all this directorial talent?
Yeah. Billy Wilder.
Yeah, Billy.
Gosh sake, the Private Life of Sherlock Holmes as Mycroft, you know.
Yeah.
And the characters, it's just amazing that the same actor could play, you know, of course, Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, The Mummy, Sherlock Holmes, and then do these classic films like Roquefort from Three Musketeers,
my favorite.
And even play a James Bond villain.
Yeah.
And one of the best Bond villains.
No, I think
sure.
so.
I mean, look at all the Bond franchise, the Lord of the Rings franchise, the Star Wars franchise. To be in those big...
Of course, the Hammer films.
Oh, and the Hammer films, definitely.
The Hammer was kind of built on his and Peter Cushing's shoulders, I think.
Well, he was in the first Hammer horror film, Kurt Frankenstein, in 1957, and he was in the last Hammer horror film, which was To the Devil a Daughter in 1976. His first role of note was in Hamlet, 1946. He played like a guard. He didn't have any roles. Peter Cushing was also in that. Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee co-starred 21 times in their career. And those movies are absolutely wonderful.
And, of course, when Hammer came back a few years ago with The Resident,
that's true.
He's in that with Oscar winner Hilary Swank.
That's right. Not a particularly good movie. But it was elevated by his presence. And a lot of movies were. I mean, you and I were we were all born at a time where we saw a lot of movies at the theater in the 70s. It was always so cool that Christopher Lee was pop up in these movies, like the James Bond movies, the Three Musketeers movies. You know, even cheesy movies like, you know, Killer Force with Peter Fonda. And
The Serial with Martin Mull.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a biker.
Yeah, it was cool. And a couple years ago, we did an article at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. We do Top 10 Tuesday a lot, and we'll pick out, we'll find an actor, and we'll try to pick his 10 best movies. But we couldn't narrow it down. We couldn't narrow down Christopher Lee's 10 best movies because, you'd have to put three or four Dracula movies in there. Good grief.
Sure, yeah.
So we came up with the idea of doing Christopher Lee's 10 best characters, which I think was a good idea. We reposted a sort of a reformatted version of that article at We Are Movie Geeks last week to commemorate his passing. But let's talk about these roles. He did Frankenstein, of course. He only did Frankenstein once, and that was 1957's Curse of Frankenstein.
Along with Peter Cushing.
Peter Cushing is Dr. Frank.
You know, I started their gothic horror series in Hammer.
We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
This is Frankenstein, who revolted against nature, who experimented with the devil and was forever cursed.
He's definitely a different take on the monster from Karloff and many of the Universal monsters. He's kind of a brutal creature in it, and he's pretty scary.
He looks kind of like more of a zombie than the flat-topped Frankenstein monster. I'm not surprised he didn't play the monster again. And then there were subsequent Hammer Frankenstein films. There were seven of them, and with Peter Cushing. But none of them really had a monster per se. They were really about Dr. Frankenstein and some of his crazy creations. Rasputin was another.
Rasputin, the mad monk, history's man of mystery.
And really, I mean, if you think about Rasputin in cinema history, Lee's role as Rasputin, he kind of owned that role as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lionel Barrymore, I think, had played him before, but I think it's Chris Lee's were mostly known for. I think Tom Baker played him in Nicholas Alexander.
Yeah.
But I remember when Hammer liked to do a lot of double features, they came out, I think it was Rasputin was paired off with the Reptile, was it? The thing is, you got like a little freebie when you went to the and I think with that you got a Rasputin beard.
Yeah, and I think Dracula, Prince of Darkness, was in those double features too, and they gave you Dracula eyes or something,
fangs or something.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
But that was Rasputin the Mad Monk, and in both of those, and Curse of Frankenstein and Horror Dracula, were all directed by Terence Fisher. And Rasputin co-starred Barbara Shelley, who was Christopher Lee's frequent co-star in a lot of those films.
She was.
Oh, yeah. So one of the Hammer players there for a while. Mm-hmm. Every other film was had her.
And she's still around. She's still living in England. I'd love for her to do some American conventions. And then of course, 1973, 1974, we had the two Musketeers films.
I love those. Oh, yes. My favorite, bar none. They were shot as one movie, then broken up into two. Richard Lester does a great job with it. But I'm telling you, Christopher Lee, his scenes with Faye Dunaway and Charlton Heston, both deliciously evil. Oh, those are great scenes. Mm-hmm. And when they did This Is Your Life, which is on YouTube, you can watch that full show. Charlton Heston, they shot like a satellite with Charlton Heston, giving, a tribute to Christopher Lee, which was really nice. But those two movies together are just, the cast, and it's just, you can just tell he's just licking his chops through every scene he's in.
And his sword fighting skills in that film are very impressive. He was a talented fencer. And he did a lot of sword fighting in a lot of films. There was a couple of pirate movies, Pirates of Blood River, that he did for Hammer. And all the way up to the Star Wars film, where he actually has a sword fight or a fight with a Yoda.
That's right.
And he was 80 years old, and he wanted to do his own lightsaber battling scenes. I think George Lucas wanted to put a stuntman in, and Christopher Lee insisted on doing those scenes himself at his age. He loved fencing, and I know people who are big fans of fencing love those Musketeer movies because they think they have some of the best fencing sequences.
Yeah, I think he did a film called Crimson Pirate with Burt Lancaster.
That's right. That was one of his early roles.
He worked with Gregory Peck and Horatio Hornblower. Yep.
Believe those are all the stars.
He plays such a great villain. He's one of the screen's greatest villains.
No doubt. I think he is the screen's greatest villain.
Yeah, then they did sort of a sequel of those Musketeer films about a dozen years later, and he reprised his role in that.
Exactly.
Wasn't it called The Fourth Musketeer?
Or The Return?
Return of the Musketeer.
The Return of the Musketeer.
With Kim Cattrall as one of the characters in it, and C. Thomas Howell. Yeah. Joining up with the fun.
Well, there you go. He played the mummy. He only played the mummy one time. And even his characterization of the mummy was unique.
The mummy, the living dead, bringing terror and death across 4,000 years.
You had Karloff and Lon Chaney, who would act really slowly, and you kind of laugh at him and say, well, I can run away from this mummy. But not Karras the mummy in 1959 for Hammer. Holy cow, that mummy was scary. That mummy moved quickly. That mummy was strong.
He takes a sword or a poker to the chest and goes right out of his back. It's great.
It is. Yeah, the mummy. He only played the mummy the one time, but, that's one of the best mummy movies. And there are some scenes where you see Christopher Lee acting in some flashbacks to ancient Egypt, too. So he's not just in the mummy costume the whole film. But that's going down our list, we're kind of going from 10 to 1. You can guess what number 1 is. Count Dooku, he played in the Star Wars movies. The Star Wars movies from... the ones that were made, 10 to 15 years ago, which people were sort of reverential when they came out, but I think now everybody really hates those things. And when the new Star Wars movies come out next year, I think those are going to look even worse in retrospect. But they had Christopher Lee, and he was by far the coolest thing in those Star Wars movies.
That was
movies.
The greatest casting news. When they said Christopher Lee was going to be in,
It's a great pity that our paths have never crossed before, Obi-Wan. Qui-Gon always spoke very highly of you.
And it was kind of a tribute to his old friend there, because of course Peter Cushing was Grand Moff Tarkin.
That's right, in the first,
the first Star Wars film, and here's another Hammer superstar joining Lucas.
Gotta love that. Also, one of my very favorite Christopher Lee movies was The Wicker Man.
Those children out there, they're jumping through the flames in the hope that the God of Fire will make them fruitful. Really, you can hardly blame them.
1973, Edward Woodward and Robin Hardy directed that film. Amazing drama about virgin sacrifices, and it's set up as a murder mystery. But I watch it all the time. I just got it on Blu-ray, and every time I watch it, I'm amazed how much music is in the film. It's really kind of a musical.
Does he do a dance in it? Christopher does. I guess does he sing a little bit in it?
Yeah, he doesn't sing so much, but he has some great lines. There is a lot of singing in it, not so much by him.
Now there's a movie I know of that he does do singing in. That's The Return of Captain Invincible, opposite Alan Arkin.
I don't think it made our top 10 list.
No, it shouldn't.
But they remade The Wicker Man with
Nicolas Cage.
I think Ellen Burstyn played Lord Summer Isle. They made her character a female. Everybody hates that movie. I don't think it's that bad.
Now, is this Wicker Man Chris's favorite film?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he praised that film. It is a remarkable film, and it's a movie that's aged really well. It's sort of ahead of its time. Another character he played was Fu Manchu. I mean, he played Fu Manchu 5 times.
Christopher Lee as the merciless Dr. Fu Manchu, who cast a black shadow of fear across innocent lives.
And he plays sort of a proto-Fu Manchu in Terror of the Tongs.
That's right.
An early Hammer film. You know, but the Fu Manchus are all in color. They're all set in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And produced by a fellow named Harry Allen Towns?
Yeah, Harry Towers, yeah.
Towers.
You know, and Christopher Lee was 6'5", a 6'5" Brit playing, this wizened Chinaman. But that's okay. They taped his eyebrows up a little bit to make his eyes slanty. The Fu Manchu movies aren't great. I've seen them all over the years. Vengeance of Fu Manchu was the first, and that was directed by Don Sharp, who did some work for Hammer, and that was a pretty good one. Face of Fu Manchu. But then the last two were actually directed by Joss Franco, Blood of Fu Manchu and Castle of Fu Manchu, and those are pretty lame. Although, Christopher Lee doesn't disappoint. He's really good in those.
Yeah, and each one of them has like a different actor playing Sir Nalen Smith.
Yeah.
So that's what
Nigel Green, I believe, played him in one.
There are a few film series where they change heroes, but the villain is always the same actor.
Yeah.
So. But no, they're very entertaining. They're nice Saturday matinee type of things to watch on a rainy afternoon. You know.
Yeah. Saruman. He worked for Peter Jackson, I guess, in six. Six films for Peter Jackson as Saruman.
A new power is rising. Its victory is at hand.
Yeah, I remember from one of the recent Hobbit films, you hear the voice before you see him, and and everybody in the theater at the screening moment is like, Christopher Lee is in this! Yeah. We were all excited for this 90-year-old actor, but that's how much he's loved, you know?
When he passed away, Peter Jackson posted on his Facebook page a really nice picture of the two of them together with Christopher Lee in character.
That's all that, yeah.
And just a very... A really nice heartfelt tribute too. Mm-hmm. So if you have a chance to, and you're on Facebook, go have a look at Peter Jackson's official page. It's a very nice, he concludes it with an icon of cinema has passed into legend.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sweet.
Yeah. Now, of course, the Hobbit films are prequels to the Lord of the Rings films. And Christopher Lee's character Saruman dies in the final,
but in the
theatrical version, they cut out his death scene. You never saw him die until it came out on DVD with the extended cut, and then it's a pretty spectacular death scene.
Oh.
I don't know why they did that. That was kind of a major character.
Oh, yeah.
I guess they needed to cut it down to 3 hours. Good for Peter Jackson for casting Christopher Lee. He was so great.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, Tim Burton loved Christopher Lee, and you talked about his voice. He was the voice of the dragon in Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, that's right.
Everybody recognized him. He also played Willy Wonka's dad in the flashbacks of... Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He was in...
The Corpse Bride. He was a voice in that.
Okay. Yeah. And Sleepy Hollow. And Dark Shadows.
He was a sailor in Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
Just incredible career.
Yeah, no doubt. And one of my favorites, it was, and we mentioned this, his villain Scaramanga in the 1974 007 film The Man with the Golden Gun, which, there's a piece of trivia, that's the only James Bond movie where Bond only kills one person. Throughout the entire film, and I don't want to give it away, but everybody's seen it. He kills Scaramanga at the very end. And, of course, you have Hervé Villechaize as Nick Knack, his little midget assistant.
Perfect.
Yeah, but in most of the Bond films, the villain has a lot of henchmen, like Goldfinger has odd jobs. Hervé Villechaize isn't really his henchman. He's like his assistant.
Yeah.
But the real threat is Scaramanga himself.
Right.
And as I recall, Krista was the step-cousin of Ian Fleming.
That's right. That's
yes.
right. In fact, Ian Fleming wanted Christopher Lee to play Dr. No in 1961. Scaramanga and one of my favorite, probably my favorite, Roger Moore. Bond.
Yeah.
Because of Lee.
Yeah, it didn't do that well at the box office, but I think in retrospect, but mostly because of Christopher Lee, it's gotten a lot of a lot of credit there.
And
a lot of the more Bonds are silly, like Moonraker is silly.
Yeah.
But I think as the years go by, we appreciate Chris Lee as the villain.
He's got such charisma, and he's one of the sexiest Bond villains. I mean, bar none. If you can come up with another one, have at it. But Christopher Lee and the white,
Handsome. Well, they're always very dapper.
Yeah, and then of course his greatest role, which he will be best remembered for is Dracula.
Yeah.
He played Dracula 7 times for Hammer Studios and 4 or 5 times outside of that. The first time was the 1958's Horror of Dracula.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely. I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
Some people consider that the best of the 7 films he made for as Dracula for Hammer. It's not really my favorite.
I think it's mine. I have a fond remembrance of seeing it for the first time when I was a kid, when I was homesick from school, and it was better than any medicine that on the market. I felt 100% better after watching that morning.
Yeah, it is great. It's way up there. I like Hammer Glamour.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Melissa Stribling was Mina in that, and she kind of was a nothing actress. Some of the other...
Valerie Gaunt.
Yeah, you had Barbara Shelley in the second one. You had Carolyn Monroe in one. Who else? Stephanie Beecham was
Veronica
in one.
Carlson.
Yeah, Veronica Carlson. Linda Hayden. You know, all the other Dracula movies, like I can name an actress. Jenny Hargraves, I can name an actress that I really liked.
Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, there was another Hammer films and Horror of Dracula. I can't really say that, but it is really great. It sort of set the groundwork for all the other Hammers.
It's got Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, which is just wonderful.
The battle at the end of it is just
a classic. Yeah. You know?
And then he made, I guess, 4 without Cushing, and then Cushing came back in the 70s for Dracula 80, 72, and Satanic Rites of Dracula, which they're all interesting in their own ways.
Of course, we were talking about the pseudo Dracula he plays in Magic Christian.
Mm-hmm.
He just does he have any lines at all?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Well,
I think he has a whip too, doesn't he? Isn't he whipping people on a ship?
I don't recall, but of course he doesn't have any dialogue in Dracula Prince of Darkness either.
No, he didn't have a lot of dialogue in any of those Dracula films. It was just his presence.
Yeah, and like I say, you talked about him being attractive. You know, Barbara Shelley really digs him.
In 1970, he started a movie for Jess Franco called Count Dracula, which was very faithful to Bram Stoker's novel. It's sort of a poorly paced film, but it's interesting because he does have a lot of dialogue in that.
Listen to them, the children of the night. What music they make.
And he's wearing a mustache and gray temples, and they try to make him look like the way Dracula was described in the novel. And Klaus Kinski plays Renfield in that one. So
is Herbert Lahm Van Helsing?
Yeah, Herbert Lahm is Van Helsing in that one,
Another Hammer veteran
who's
a fan of the opera.
That's right.
Next Monday, TCM is having a full day of Christopher Lee films.
Good.
Should have been a full weekend, by gosh.
It could have been.
Should have been a full month, doggone it. He was in 280 movies.
It runs from 6:15 a.m. in the morning till 6 p.m. at night. They could have gone much, There were a lot of films like Airport 77. Where's that? One of my personal favorites.
Mm-hmm. But The Mummy, Curse of Frankenstein, Horror of Dracula, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Dracula Lives from the Grave, Horror Express, which was a film he made in Spain with Peter Cushing, which interesting film, and The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers.
Not a bad list there. I might have thrown in the Bond film. I might have thrown in one of the Lord of the Rings films. But if they do a full month-long celebration in October, put those in there.
Yes. But at least it's being done during the day, too, because a lot of times their tributes are done overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is smack dab in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
So
get
your DVR cleaned out because
make some space.
So rest in peace, Christopher Lee. I think he was probably my favorite. You know, next to Clint Eastwood, I think he was probably my favorite living actor.
Damn.
He was married to his wife, Git, for 54 years.
Did you ever get to see him in person?
I didn't. He did a couple of conventions. I know he did the FANEX convention in Baltimore. I know he was very strict about only signing his autobiography, which was entitled Tall, Dark, and Gruesome, a great name for his autobiography. He did a couple of conventions, but, you know, he just kept working and working. He didn't have time to do that kind of stuff. But he was always very generous to his fans.
Well, I'm one up on you because I got to see him when he was in Chicago about 14 years ago, 15 years ago. He was one of the judges at the Chicago International Film Festival, and they did a special night.
Oh, wow.
They did a Q&A with him at the Music Box Theater. I think you've been there before there on Southport and Addison. At the Music Box Theater, he did a Q&A, and then they played Horror of Dracula.
Wow.
And to hear that booming voice going out through the auditorium was just fantastic.
Was he at the screening then? Did he speak a little before the screening?
Well, he spoke. They did he was interviewed by, I forget the interviewer, but he spoke a little bit before, and he had a couple of nice stories about Peter Cushing and couldn't have been more charming. He even told a story about checking into the hotel in Chicago, and when he's registering, the guy says, you've got an interesting voice. You ever thought about going into acting?
Did he and Vincent Price have the same birthdays? Have I read that? Different years, but the same birthday?
Yeah, May 27th, yeah.
And then Cushing a couple of days before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing. Love of course, it. One of the last things I saw Chris do was a Christmas greeting wearing the hat that Vincent Price gave.
We posted that years ago.
Oh, yeah. That's just charming.
Yeah, yeah. So Christopher Lee, gone. But not forgotten. We love Christopher Lee. And we're going to have to wrap it up with We Are Movie Geeks, the show. We'll be back next week. We can talk about Dope and maybe a little bit more about Inside Out and lots of other things. So check us out and be sure to check out our website, wearemoviegeeks.com. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
All right, signing off.
Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that.